This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We tend to think of evolution as something that used to happen, a force that shaped our natural world and then somehow just stopped. But of course, evolution hasn't stopped. In fact, with our antibiotics, pesticides, and myriad environmental pollutants, we may be driving evolution in new directions. That's the central thesis of a new book by environmental toxicologist and author Dr. Emily Monison. Monison is adjunct faculty in the Department of Environmental Conservation at UMass Amherst and the author of three books about the relationship between humans and natural systems. Her most recent is Unnatural Selection: How We Are Changing Life Gene by Gene. Emily Monison, welcome back to Living Lab.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Where did the idea from this book come from? How did you first start thinking about whether or not we, our human activities, are driving evolution?
So the book before this was about how life evolved in response to toxic chemicals, so going back billions of years, and how a lot of the defensive systems evolved in response to toxic chemicals. And the last chapter of that book was, well, life evolved over a long time, all these defensive mechanisms in response to toxic chemicals, and it's still evolving in response to toxic chemicals. And so the last chapter dealt with some of the resistances that I write about in this book, and so that kind of expanded into this book. And those resistances are the more rapid kinds of evolution, not the kind of evolution, as you mentioned, that happens over billions and millions of years, but the kind of evolution that happens over potentially days, months, and years, and can have consequences for human health and the environment.
When you mention this idea, when you talk about the idea that we could be accelerating evolution and driving it in new directions with toxic chemicals, whether they're medicines or environmental pollutants, how do your colleagues in the scientific community respond? Is that something that they immediately say, oh yeah, of course, or does it kind of surprise or put people off perhaps?
No, I think most people say, oh yeah, of course. I think it's not necessarily that we're, so I just want to clarify that we're not actually accelerating evolution. We're putting pressure on, our chemicals are basically imposing selection pressure. And so it's a course that would normally happen, but we're just putting strong pressure so that it's happening in ways that is not beneficial to us.
I mean, so the title Unnatural Selection, a play on, obviously, Darwin's natural selection. One argument, though, could be that we are part of the natural world. We are animals and part of the ecosystem. So is this actually unnatural selection, or is this just kind of the way of the world?
Yeah, I've thought about that. I thought, you know, I've been thinking about that. Is it really unnatural? Because evolution is a natural process. Chemicals are natural things. But what we're doing is putting a lot of extra chemicals into the world and a lot of synthetic chemicals. And so we're really changing the environment. And so it depends. And yes, we are a part of the whole world ecosystem. And so that's been one of the problems, that people have removed humans for years and thought of us as separate. And we're really not. We're part of it all. But on the other hand, we have a huge influence on life in the world. And so I think that's where the unnatural part comes from, because we really are influencing these things in a way that certainly wouldn't happen if we weren't here. And it's not really to anyone's benefit a lot of times.
You cover a huge breadth in this book of concrete examples, from antibiotic resistance, vaccines, chemotherapy, pesticides, and then into the environmental pollutants. And we'll go through a few of those. But I want to start with antibiotic resistance, because I think that's perhaps one of the most visible and well-known examples. It's something that's becoming a real part of the public conscience right now, that we need to worry about antibiotic resistance. And that's actually where you start the book. I wonder if you could read a little just from the beginning of the book.
Sure. I see resistance all the time, says nurse practitioner Maggie G. Her nervous blue eyes convey both compassion and the weariness of someone who has seen it all. Over the course of 25 years, the Western Massachusetts nurse has treated farmers, hilltown hippies, and teens seeking treatment for STDs and fevers, as well as men, women, and children who walk for miles and wait patiently with festering wounds and separating tumors in the Sierra Leone clinic that she visits once a year. One constant throughout all of Maggie's experience is methicillin-resistant staph, or MRSA. Back in the late 80s, when Maggie was just finishing nursing school, MRSA was rare. But over the years, she has witnessed the rise of this drug-resistant bug, tending to countless cases. One of her most memorable involved a young camp counselor whose infected toe turned into a life-threatening hole in her heart. When we spoke, Maggie was working with recovering addicts at a psych hospital. MRSA spreads so easily in the needle-using addict populations through needle sharing or festering open wounds that Maggie says all addicts are often treated presumptively, meaning the staff doesn't always test but assumes drug resistance. It's a reasonable assumption. In some places, nearly 50% of the needle-using populations today may be positive for community-acquired MRSA.
Needle-using drug addicts is one subpopulation, and it could be easy for people to say, oh, well, that's not me. I don't need to worry about this. How widespread is the problem of antibiotic resistance at this point, though?
It's widespread. I mean, it's something that can affect anyone. You've heard of kids in locker rooms spreading around MRSA through towels. My daughter had a staph infection, and we worried that it was MRSA. So it's really anybody and everybody has the potential, I think, to be exposed to MRSA.
Antibiotics really only came into widespread medicinal use in the middle of the 20th century. And you go into a lot of the history of how antibiotics were first developed. How early was resistance first seen?
I believe that resistance was seen sometimes within months of using the antibiotics on a large scale. So even with penicillin, when they were first, there's some stories of when they were first treating soldiers with either sulfa drugs or penicillin, I can't remember, but within, and they were treating them presumptively when they first came into the large barracks to sort of prevent disease. But I think within months, there was some notice that those antibiotics were losing potency. And even Fleming, who is discoverer of penicillin, warned just a few years after penicillin really came into use that we need to be careful how we use penicillin. This was in 1945, because bacteria would become resistant to it and penicillin could soon become useless. But nobody seemed to listen.
I mean, it's 70 years later, and it still seems that to a large degree we're not listening. Why wasn't that warning heeded? It use just kept skyrocketing and spreading instead.
It's kind of unbelievable to me. But I think part of it is even the understanding of evolution and understanding that evolution can happen rapidly. I think part of it is, you know, it's easy for us to criticize people back in the 60, 70 years ago when our understanding of biology and bacteriology and all sorts of things was not at the level that it is now. So because there are some stories of back in the 50s when some of the first reports of multi-drug resistant bacteria were coming out, nobody believed that that could even be possible. Then there were reports, one thing that bacteria do is they can share resistance. They share little bits of DNA between different kinds of bacteria. When that was first discovered, I think in the 50s or 60s, that was also something that was unbelievable. And now that's something that, you know, everybody in this bacteriology world and medical world knows to be true. So I think it's, you know, that's part of it. But why we're having such a problem now that we've known all this stuff for 10, 20, 30 years, it's hard to imagine. I think it's partly education of the public.
Is part of it just how scary the idea is, that it's a little hard to face? I mean, the idea that we could be, as some experts have said, facing essentially a post-antibiotic world where we no longer have the tools to fight infections that 100 years ago were killers and that we now think of as just kind of a nuisance. And the idea that those could once again become killers, and we don't really seem to have a good strategy for getting this under control.
I mean, yeah, it's a really scary prospect. And people have been saying this for probably a decade, that we're facing the potential of going back to pre-antibiotic times. But things are changing now. I think there are more studies on sort of what happens when you scale back in antibiotics. Can antibiotic-sensitive strains reemerge? And they can if you scale back. There's much more awareness now. In the book I just write about, you know, my kids are, you know, 20 years old now. When I first brought them for ear infections or whatever ailed them, we would quickly get, what I called the pink stuff, which was, I think it was
amoxicillin.
And
very familiar in our house as well.
Yeah. But, I think that if I had, they weren't tested for anything. And you just told me that now they can quickly test for some viruses like
flu. Yeah. Swap. I mean, I just had my youngest son in the doctor's office earlier this week. Of course, it's flu season. And they did a quick nasal swab, tested for flu, and if it had come back positive, though, they were talking about using Tamiflu. I mean, part of this is, yeah, you know, the idea that a lot of things are viral, and so when we say antibiotics, usually what we're talking about is actually antibacterials, but we now actually have antiviral medications as well. Are they also subject to this this phenomenon of resistance?
Oh, yeah, because, you know, so what I didn't mention is, you know, bacteria, some of the ingredients you need for evolution is you need to have a lot of variation or mutations or, you know, the potential for genetic variation. You need to have heritability that you can pass this on, and you need to have, for rapid evolution, something that reproduces very quickly, which bacteria do. And they also can mutate as they, anytime you reproduce, there's potential for mutation. So bacteria are very good at that, and viruses are even better at that. So viruses can evolve even more rapidly than bacteria. And so there is the problem of resistance to antivirals as well. However, I do believe that the flu antivirals right now still work with the strains of flu that are going around. So, but there's the risk of the more you use those antivirals, the greater potential that the viruses will become resistant, and then they won't be useful anymore. But I think, you know, where I was going was, I was just going to say that there is that testing now. So that's one strategy to actually reduce the potential for resistances, is to test and to use the right drug, match the right drug with the right pathogen, which didn't used to happen 20 years ago. We would just try one. If that didn't work, we'd try another one. Maybe it was viral. Nobody ever tested because we didn't have that rapid swab. So I think that's a hopeful thing, that we can sort of do better testing and better matching with the antibiotics.
To simply scale back the amount that we're using.
To reduce the use, and to just use it when it's absolutely necessary in the right case, in the right pathogen. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about how bacteria actually evolve resistance. I mean, how is it that some of them actually aren't killed by the antibiotics, and that we end up with these resistant strains? Is it new mutations? Is it, what's going on actually to create resistance?
Well, so it's a combination of things, but there is the potential for new mutations. So anytime any organism, any cell, anywhere divides, there's always the potential for a mutation. Sometimes those mutations might actually be beneficial to that organism, not always. So if bacteria is going along and it's dividing and it's getting hammered with amoxicillin, that's putting a lot of pressure on it. Some of those bacteria might be dying from that, but one might just happen to pop up with some ability to withstand the amoxicillin through a lot of different ways. It could either start pumping the drug out, it could metabolize the drug faster, it could change the target that amoxicillin is going after. This is just a, for example.
Right.
So that's one way, is through new mutation. But probably an even more important way, I think, for bacteria is, as I mentioned, that they are very good at sharing DNA. And so bacteria have these little round structures of DNA called plasmids, and those plasmids tend to carry what are called auxiliary genes. So some of the genes for things like when bacteria produce toxins or they produce resistances. So some of the genes for resistances carried on these plasmids. And when bacteria get all mixed up together, as they tend to do, because we've all heard we have, like, you know, tons of bacteria, lots of different kinds, when they're all mixed together, sometimes they'll share these plasmids. They have basically what's called bacterial sex, and the DNA can go from one bacterium to another, and it can go from one strain of bacteria to another and a different type of bacteria. So it's pretty wild. And so these resistance genes can evolve in one kind of bacteria and be transferred to another bacteria. And also, some of these resistance genes are really, really old. So they've discovered that in caves that really haven't been touched by humans, and so these haven't evolved in response to the chemicals that we're using or the antibiotics we use, there exists bacteria that have many of the resistance genes to a lot of the antibiotics we're using.
Why would there be antibiotic resistance genes in these natural populations? Why is that even out there?
I think that's a really good question. So some of the scientists that I talked to for this book, some of the ideas is that it's possible that sometimes the antibiotics are just chemicals. A lot of times we get most of our antibiotics from bacteria and from fungi. So they're molecules that are produced by these organisms. And some people think, you know, they might have been produced either for protection of that organism, because they're all jumbled up together in the soil or whatever, or they could have gotten it, or they could have evolved them as sort of communication chemicals, so that they're just communicating. And if you're going to send a chemical to communicate and it does its job and it gets to the next bacteria and then that bacterium gets its message, then you need to destroy that message, because then you'll keep getting that signal. So maybe they started to evolve enzymes to break up those chemical messages. So it could either be they were trying to destroy toxins that were being aimed at him from other bacteria or exposed to from other bacteria, or they could have been destroying chemical messages. I don't know if anybody knows exactly, you know, how and why some of these evolved, but those are some of the reasons that people think they had them. And so they've had these ever since they've all existed together.
I've heard both in the natural interactions that you're talking about there and also in the medical setting, the evolution of resistance compared to kind of an arms race, an escalating arms race, that, you know, we're throwing medicines out, they're trying to become resistant, we're throwing more medicines out. But part of what's been happening is that we're not developing new antibiotics. Why haven't we seen actually the escalation on our part to new antibiotics that might be more effective?
That's a good question, too. I'm not really sure of the... I think some of the reasons why is that it's... So a lot of the antibiotics, as you mentioned, a lot of them were developed in the 50s and 60s, and there haven't been a whole lot of new classes since then. I think it's difficult to sort of probably grow and isolate and work with some of the bacteria that they've, you know, eventually gotten antibiotics from. I know that there had been, you know, a lot of activity in producing synthetic antibiotics, which was not that successful, I believe. Most of our antibiotics do come from natural sources and are not synthetic. And even the synthetics that there are, the bacteria become resistant to those as well. So I think, and maybe it's partly the research effort. So part of the problem was there wasn't a huge research effort being put in, effort into developing antibiotics. And that was probably, I would guess that was a financial thing. So there needs to be more incentive to develop antibiotics too. And now here you are thinking about developing something where your target gets resistant. That's probably not a really good model for
somebody who wants to make a lot of incentive there, right?
And the other thing is they aren't these blockbuster drugs. You can't sell them, and you don't want to, now we know, to everybody and anybody, right? So when you're making a heart drug or something like that, you know, the consumer base is probably really large, and I think it's not that way for antibiotics.
That's Dr. Emily Monison, author of Unnatural Selection, How We're Changing Life Gene by Gene. In recent weeks, we have actually heard an announcement of a new class of antibiotic, the first in decades, that may be able to avoid resistance. We'll talk more about that and other examples of humans changing evolution after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest today is Dr. Emily Monison. She's author of a new book, Unnatural Selection, How We Are Changing Life Gene by Gene. Emily, before the break, we were talking about the development of new antibiotics to try to counter the spread of resistant bacteria. And as I mentioned, in recent weeks, we heard this very exciting announcement. Researchers at Northeastern University developed a new antibiotic called Texabactin. It's not approved for use yet. It still has to go through a lot of testing. But it appears to be very effective against resistant strains of staph and others. And they actually have said that they think it might be harder for microbes to develop resistance to this particular antibiotic. And in fact, Dr. Kim Lewis, who was one of the lead scientists on that project, we have a little clip of him talking about whether or not he thinks it would be possible to develop resistance.
We found something that hasn't been seen before, an antibiotic that is largely free of resistance. Because, you see, there's a dogma in my field that bacteria will always develop resistance. So I looked at the facts, and I realized that nature evolved a compound that is seriously protected from resistance development. That was the driving force behind the evolution of Texabactin.
He calls this idea that resistance will always pop up dogma. Do you think it's just dogma, or is that really supported? Do you think that it is possible to develop an antibiotic that will not eventually have bugs become resistant to it?
So I think I need to know more about what the actual product is, how it works, and what the mechanisms are that make it potentially, as he calls it, maybe resistance proof. But at least from my own, so I can't really speak to that particular case, but in my own experience with writing this book, it seems that every time somebody thinks that they have something that is resistance proof, it gets trumped by nature. And the best example there is I wrote about Roundup, the herbicide, and the target of Roundup was something that was believed to be essentially resistance proof. But eventually, bacteria and weeds in particular resistance started popping up all over the place. So my feeling is, especially with something that's as valuable as a new antibiotic, I think until we really, really know that that's the case, it seems like once it gets to production and use, it would be a good thing to be careful with our use and protective of it until we really know that you could use it everywhere and anywhere, because we have so few working antibiotics, and it's great that there's this potential new one. We wouldn't want to lose it, and we wouldn't want to not use it when it's useful too. So,
we've talked a lot about overuse or misuse of antibiotics in a medical setting as one way to breed resistance. But there's also a lot of antibiotic use in agriculture, and that's been the focus of a lot of concern and criticism. How does as antibiotic use in agriculture lead to resistance and the spread of resistance?
Well, I think it's just that it's used in such large quantities. So of some, say, at least when I wrote the book, 37 million, I think it's pounds of antibiotics and 30 million. So 75 to 80% of the antibiotics that are used and produced here are used in agriculture, I believe.
So
it's
most of it.
A huge amount.
The majority of the antibiotic use in the United States is not actually for medical purposes.
That's correct. It's not. And so you can get exposure to, if pathogens get exposed in agricultural products, they can develop resistance there. Just getting out into the environment, they can, through the agricultural practices. So I think that just the use, putting it out into the environment, putting it out into using it in animals, and exposing it to bacteria in that way, all provide the potential for the development of resistance.
In addition to antibiotic resistance, in your book, as I've said, you cover a huge breadth. And the second chapter is actually on vaccines. And I have to say, I was kind of shocked because the idea that there could be resistance developed to vaccines had never really occurred to me. Is there the same concern there, or how do vaccines potentially pose a threat in terms of driving evolution of the pathogens that they target?
Okay, so that was a question that I was interested in part because I vaccinated my children and they had so many vaccines, and I wondered if that's really a natural process and what the outcome of that might be. So I wanted to look at that, whether or not vaccination could drive evolution. And it's not exactly a resistance, but it does, the bacteria can evolve in response to those vaccines. And so I investigated that. The two examples that I could find there's one example of where vaccines did drive evolution and cause the virus to become more virulent, and that's with a disease called Marek's disease, which is in chickens. It's actually a cancer-causing virus in chickens, and what happened there is that there's such large coverage. They were so good at vaccinating the majority of the population that it was a very strong selective pressure on those chickens. And what vaccines do is they pump up your immune system. They get your immune system going. And you had mentioned earlier about sort of the warfare between the pathogen and the drugs. It's the same thing. So our it's the viruses against our immune response, and our immune response is very good at driving evolution of viruses. That's just a natural process. And so vaccines make our immune response even better, or ready to respond to those viruses. And so in that way, there's the potential that it could drive evolution. The problem is we're talking about evolution is really something that happens on a population level. So you really need to have sort of the whole population involved. And so in the Merrick's case, all those chickens were vaccinated and they responded, and the virus responded actually by becoming more virulent.
We constantly hear the advice that, right now with a measles outbreak on the West Coast, and hearing, part of the problem is this idea of herd immunity or group immunity, that we need almost everybody vaccinated to protect the people that aren't vaccinated, that are too young or whatever. And yet you're saying that it's exactly that situation that potentially poses a risk for breeding resistance.
Okay. So I need to clarify this. So some viruses are better at evolving in response to the immune system and in response to vaccines than other viruses. So we've been able to eradicate some disease by having huge coverage with vaccines like polio. And for whatever reason, measles was one until this recent outbreak. And it's not because the vaccine... it's because people weren't vaccinated that we had those outbreaks.
Right.
But those viruses, as far as anyone knows, have not really evolved in response to that large coverage. So it's not something that is inevitably going to happen. It just happens with some kinds of viruses that are highly evolvable. So some viruses seem to be much more evolvable than others, like flu virus is incredibly evolvable. And so, and that's
which is why we have to get a new vaccine every single year.
It's why we have to get a new vaccine every year. It's called antigenic drift. So they evolve in response to our immune system naturally. And it's one of the reasons why this this year's vaccine isn't as effective as they would like it to be, because the flu, it's always a game of prediction. What flu strains to make the vaccine against. And the strain had drifted further than they had realized.
So with antibiotic resistance, the widespread advice is limit the use of antibiotics right. as much as possible to try to limit this evolution and spread of resistance. But with vaccines, no, not a reason to limit the use of vaccines.
I think that's right. I think that we're talking about different kinds of processes and different responses to these. And actually, one of the things that would be good to conserve antibiotics is if there was more vaccination against some of these diseases that are commonly treated with antibiotics. But there aren't as many vaccines against bacteria than there are as against viruses. And I couldn't really tell you why.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Dr. Emily Monison, author of a new book, Unnatural Selection, How We Are Changing Life Gene by Gene. Now, you said at the beginning of the show that the way you got into this is kind of from your own background as an environmental toxicologist and looking at how animals in natural ecosystems that have been impacted by pollution are evolving new ways to survive. So give us a couple examples of the evolution of essentially resistance to pollutants that we've seen crop up.
Well, the best known example, which a lot of work has been done here at the Woods Hole Oceanographic, was the resistance in killifish. So little minnow-like fish that have evolved resistance to organic chemicals like PCBs and dioxins. And so what's interesting about that is that these are vertebrates. So most of the book that I'm writing about invertebrates, things that have incredibly high reproductive rates. They reproduce very rapidly. And so we tend to think, oh, of course, viruses, bacteria, weeds would evolve rapidly. But when it comes to something like vertebrates that, you know, they don't have as many offspring. They take longer to mature. They just live longer. It's kind of surprising that vertebrates can evolve so rapidly, too. And one of the first examples, which I just thought was really interesting, was a researcher, Claude Boyd, who I had interviewed, who's along with his major advisor, Denzel, I think it was Ferguson, discovered one of the first cases of fish and frogs that had become resistant to the chemicals used in the farm fields back in the early 60s. And that was when DDT was in its heyday and lots of DDT was being used. And his advisor thought, you know, if invertebrates can evolve resistance, maybe vertebrates can too. Why shouldn't they? And sure enough, they went out into these farm fields where there would be ponds and the fields were drenched in pesticides and they'd see all sorts of dead animals and birds and fish and frogs. But they also found some living specimens of fish and frogs that just seemed pretty happy in those ponds. And they brought them back and realized that they had evolved resistance to DDT. And so since then, there have been other examples like the killifish that have evolved resistance to PCBs and dioxins. There's tomcod in the Hudson River that has also evolved resistance. Salamanders that have evolved resistance to all the salts that run off at roadside ponds. You know, roadside ditches. So there's increasing evidence that lots of different species can evolve resistance to a lot of the chemicals that we're putting out there as pollutants. But it's also probably a small proportion of animals that are exposed that can evolve resistance. So that's part of the
problem. And when you say resistance, are they completely healthy, completely unaffected by these pollutants? Or is it just that they have found some way to limp through and simply aren't killed by it?
Well, so far as anybody can find in most of these species, many of them seem to do quite well and they live, you know, you can find fish living in areas where they've lived there for decades, and they're resistant to these chemicals. And if you put fish that are completely naive to those chemicals, they would die. And as far as anyone can tell, there's always been one of the dogma for resistances is that if animals evolve resistance, that, you know, there's some change in their genes, that they might be producing more of one kind of enzyme or more of one kind of protein, that there's a trade-off. So the belief was always that there would be a trade-off if you're going to evolve resistance to something. And I think people are not always finding that to be the case, at least at what, you know, we can only find what we're looking for, what we know to look for. And so you never know. There can always be something happening that we just don't realize in an animal. But for most part, a lot of these animals look pretty healthy. That said, there are some places where there have been trade-offs. There are fish that live in highly metal-contaminated rivers that seem to evolve. Their way of dealing with living in that and surviving is that they mature rapidly, and so they have their offspring younger, and they die younger. But that's a way that the population has survived in that contaminated area. So that was a trade-off.
With the microbes, you were saying there's two possibilities for resistance. You could either have variability that already existed, genetic variability that already existed naturally, that we're just selecting for one of those, or there could actually be new mutations arising. But with these slower growing organisms, are they able to create new mutations, or are we really just looking at variability that was already in the population?
So that's a really good question. I think, so at least with some of the work in the Hudson River, it seems that the altered genes that conferred resistance to PCBs seem to have existed in the population, and that's called standing genetic variation. Why there would be these genes that sort of enable you to deal with these chemicals that have only been around for 50, 60, or 70 years, I think is anybody's guess. So I think sometimes, at least in vertebrates and, as you say, in the slower growing populations, it seems to be that standing genetic variation rather than the emergence of a new gene is important. But I don't know that any, my guess is you could also have a new gene spreading through the population if it was a really beneficial gene. Actually, well, and I think it's probably hard to tell without a lot of genetics whether it's been there all along or not. But there's also example from many years ago of rats becoming resistant to warfarin or rat killer, too. So that was another example of vertebrates evolving rapidly. But also you have to think that these fish, so the fish we're talking about, are not the really long-lived species. They're the species that reproduce every year. They don't take that long to mature. They have many offspring, maybe 100 or so, or, you know, offspring a year. So they're pretty prolific. So compared to a tuna fish or something else, you know, that might be more sensitive to these pollutants. If somebody's going to evolve,
right, it's going to be these smaller, faster growing fish.
Smaller, faster growing ones.
And we should be clear. I mean, when we say a new mutation arising in response to this, it's not like the antibiotics or the chemicals that we're throwing at these are actually actively mutating the DNA. It's right. That just through natural processes, mutations pop up, right? We're not talking about the chemicals themselves causing the changes in the DNA.
Right. That would be a whole different thing, although there is some concern that there's that possibility, but that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is just a random mutation that just pops up and happens to be beneficial.
I'm talking with Dr. Emily Monison. She's author of Unnatural Selection, How We're Changing Life Gene by Gene. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the possibility that we could be causing ourselves to evolve in response to the chemicals we're putting into the environment. I'm Heather Goldstone. This is Living Lab. More after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking this hour with Dr. Emily Monison. She's author of a new book, Unnatural Selection, How We Are Changing Life Gene by Gene. Emily, before the break, we were talking about animals, not just microbes or even insects or weeds, but vertebrate animals, frogs, fish, evolving resistance to toxins, essentially, that we've put out into the environment. And there's clearly a benefit for them to be able to survive these, but there are potential ramifications for the rest of the ecosystem you talked about. And one of them is, you mentioned in the book, is the fact that, you know, if you've got these small fish that are taking up large amounts of these toxins but living with it, they can then pass them on to other animals in the ecosystem that eat those fish and that might not be able to evolve resistance to them.
Right. So one of the examples of that is animals that eat fish are mink are exquisitely sensitive to toxicity from PCBs and dioxins. And so the thinking is that in some places along the Hudson and other contaminated places, the mink population is not what it should be, if it's there at all. And that's partially, they think, because they've been eating animals that carry high loads of PCBs, and they're probably fish that are resistant to PCBs that can take up a lot of that chemical. And the same thing, if you have birds that come by, migratory birds eating those fish, you know, every once in a while, they're going to get a really high hit of those kinds of chemicals. And those animals probably aren't going to evolve resistance to PCBs. And so it's a way that they can. So that's one problem with resistant animals, is that they're sort of transporters for some of these chemicals.
You also mentioned this really interesting example of how different animals in an ecosystem might respond to a single toxin, where it might make one animal really sluggish or confused or something, but another animal still able to function really quickly, and it throws off the interaction. So the sluggish one might not be able to catch food as well anymore, or might be caught more by something else, and it can completely throw off all the interactions, not just the health of a particular organism.
Right. So there's a study site in New Jersey that had all sorts of toxic metals and polyaromatic hydrocarbons, combustion products, and PCBs and dioxins, and a whole mix of stuff. And so, as you say, the predators weren't really good predators. The prey was kind of off. There were carnivores that were eating detritus or the, you know, muck. They were living with this stuff. They just weren't acting normally. And so you can imagine that eventually that there's the potential for that system to kind of collapse, given one more, you know, it's just not a system that's working as it evolved to be, because it's all under the influence of these toxic chemicals. And so one of the things is we seldom look at these kinds of interactions. So before, when I mentioned that those fish seem fine that have evolved in the Hudson, and mm-hmm. the killifish that evolved in response to PCBs, I mean, they're also living. We're looking at just those fish and just the survival of those fish and their offspring, and those seem to be doing fine. But there's a lot of other things that you need to be looking at that are very difficult to tease apart. Like, are they behaving properly? Are they being the predators they should be? Can they avoid prey? What will happen when there's other stresses to them? So, you know, we're changing the climate, and so there's going to be temperature changes potentially. And so how will they handle those kinds of stresses? So there's a lot of things that we can't look at. So when we think something looks healthy, or, you know, it might be that's what we can see, There's the potential that there's more to that story that we just can't detect.
I mean, is that part of the response to the idea that, okay, well, we're part of the ecosystem. Yes, we're changing things, but clearly life is able to adapt. There will still be something. So why should we bother cleaning up our act if everything can just evolve into something new? I mean, why not just let ecosystems evolve in response to these pressures?
Well, so that's the key right there. You said if everything can evolve to something new, and not everything, everything might have the potential, but it doesn't have the time. So those things that do have the time and the rapid reproduction can do that. So if we want to live in a world of bugs and bacteria and killifish and tomcod without other animals, that's fine. That would be one scenario, but I think that's probably not the kind of world that we want to live in. We want to live in a more diverse world. So it's really not a good idea to let those things go. And I think that was one of the concerns, actually, when I was writing the book, was, you know, somebody will come along and say, so fine, let these wildlife evolve and let's not clean up. But that's really not a good answer.
What about the selfish perspective? If we're putting all of these chemicals into the environment, what are the ramifications for us, for our own health and our own place in the ecosystem? Is there the potential that we're putting these kind of evolutionary pressures on ourselves?
Do we have the potential to evolve in response to these toxicants as well?
Yeah.
Or I think if you looked on a really long time scale, if we were exposed to the, you know, so we're one of those more sluggish species. We're long lived. We only have a couple of kids. It takes us. So, for example, for the killifish that evolved in response to PCBs, they probably evolved. They could have evolved in maybe 10, 15, 20 generations. Okay, now think how long it would take for us to have that 10, 15, 20 generations. We're not even as prolific as killifish. So we're talking thousands of years. So I think if we're thinking about our lifestyle and how we live and, you know, whether we're going to evolve, say, resistance to air pollutants, probably not going to happen. Somebody might have a gene that allows them to live, you know, to metabolize nasty stuff in the air or PCBs or something like that that's nasty. But the chances that that's going to spread through the population and our lifetimes or our grandchildren or their grandchildren or on and on and on is very unlikely. So even the times that there are the emergence of a beneficial gene, like the ability to tolerate milk through lifetime, probably took thousands of years for that to actually become, to get fixed in the populations.
I mean, humans have gone through rapid evolution, and I'm thinking of the bubonic plague, but it's not a pleasant experience. Some people were naturally able to respond to the plague and survive it. And so now that resistance to plague, if you like, in humans is more widespread, but only because 2/3 of the population of Europe was killed. I mean, and that's essentially what happens in the bacteria, in the animals, in whatever else is evolving resistance. We're talking about them, you know, evolving the ability to survive, but that only comes about because the vast majority of the population actually dies.
Yeah, that's a great point. We're just not willing to do that. We're not a natural sort of population anymore. We treat disease, we change things so that most of us will survive if we can help it.
Is there any downside with regard to trying to eradicate diseases, even if we were able to do it with vaccines without the problem of resistance and superbugs? Is there any problem in an evolutionary or health ecosystem health perspective from us getting rid of diseases? Would there be anything wrong with a disease-free world?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know that I've really thought about, you know, if there's any problem, but I can tell you that there's something like, so we know that there's, I don't know, millions, trillions, however many viruses, and we know that I think something like 8% of our genome came from viruses. So if we tried to eradicate everything that bothered us, you just never know where helpful genes or helpful whatever it is might come from. And even pathogens, you're getting rid of bacteria, you're changing structure. I would think that the removing things from the world probably isn't a great idea. But that said, it was a good thing to probably remove polio, smallpox. So it's a tough one to answer. But I
mean,
think
it's interesting because, yeah, it's very much our perspective, kind of how we're looking at an organism and what value we put on it, because we're happy to eradicate polio. But then on the other hand, we worry greatly about the number of animals or plants or other organisms that we are causing to go extinct by some other mechanism. And so it's really from our perspective, what is their value or their detriment to our personal health, not the perhaps the broader perspective that seems to drive that.
Right. And really, we don't know. I mean, I would think that when it comes to the big systems and ecosystems and biological diversity, I think there's so much that we don't know in how organisms interact that you just never know what changing that could do. But that's a question well beyond me.
Reading the book, it struck me that we use this word resistance, which on one hand is a very accurate description of what happens. You know, microbes become resistant to the antibiotics that we're using to try to kill them, and weeds become resistant to Roundup, and, you know, so on and so on. But just this word resistance has this kind of militaristic tone to it, you know, that we're trying to conquer, and this is the resistance that is, you know, rising up to meet the conquerors. Do you think that's symptomatic of a broader attitude that we have about our place in or toward natural systems? And is there an alternative way of looking at things that might be healthier?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that it is a way of looking at things, and it's probably not the healthiest way of looking at things. It's militaristic. And so when we try to really stamp something out and hit something with a hammer, like bacteria, then we're really causing, we're really putting strong selective pressure on that organism to evolve. If we hit it a little bit more lightly and maybe try to control it rather than to completely wipe it out, maybe it wouldn't evolve resistance as quickly. And another way of looking at that is also same thing with weeds. I think a lot of, you know, in agricultural situations, there's some thinking that, you know, maybe if you let some weeds live, that, you know, maybe it would be different. You wouldn't have to use so many pesticides and herbicides. And so if you had sort of a mixed crop. So I think we need to look at things differently. And that is one of the solutions, I think, going forward is sort of to maybe tread a little bit more lightly even when thinking about whether it's disease or treating weeds or getting rid of insects, instead of trying to just totally hammer them.
Learning to live with things, even if we might think that they're pests, as opposed to trying to get rid of them.
We're at a low level and trying to, yeah, control them a little better than trying to wipe them out.
Has writing this book, or even the three books that you've written and the research that you've done over the past several years, changed the way that you do things? Your thinking on taking antibiotics, on getting vaccinated, on treating diseases, on treating your lawn, does it change your everyday thinking and the way that you act?
A little bit. I would certainly say it does with the antibiotics. I mean, now when I cut myself and I look at the triple antibiotic ointment, I think I should probably just wash with soap and water. So that things like that have changed. I've always vaccinated the kids, and I would continue myself getting vaccines. I think that, at least from what I've seen in the research, that I think for the diseases that we vaccinate against, there's not a problem with vaccination, and I've become much more aware of how quickly viruses can evolve, some viruses like the flu and some other viruses, and so I think prevention is really important. So I think I've become more aware of how important prevention is. I haven't ever treated my lawn with pesticides, so I haven't changed that one.
Has it changed at all maybe what you eat or what you buy, being aware of farming practices or industrial practices, the use of pesticides or antibiotics in farming?
I have to say, well, so the current research that I'm doing is changing the way I would buy produce, in part because I'm looking into what's called late blight, and which is a devastating fungal disease on potatoes and tomatoes. It's what caused Irish potato famines. It's a little off topic, but late blight is one of the reasons that potatoes are so heavily treated with pesticides and fungicides, and I didn't realize that potatoes were so heavily treated. So yeah, I would look for organic potatoes now. But as far as other, I mean, I've always kind of mixed and tried to, because buying organic is expensive. And buying local is sometimes better than buying organic. So, you know, it's, but I do look at the, I live in an area where there's lots of corn crops, and you can see how whistle clean they are between those corn rows, probably because they're using Roundup. And so it just makes me think a little bit more about wanting to, whether or not I want to support that kind of an industry.
So is that perhaps a forthcoming book?
The one about the funguses is a forthcoming book. Some of the more devastating diseases that we have today worldwide are fungal diseases, emerging fungal diseases, not necessarily in humans. So it's a little bit of departure, because this one would really focus on agricultural and wildlife diseases.
Well, I look forward to seeing that and to talking to you again when that comes out.
Good. Thanks. Thank you for having me.
Emily Monison is author of Unnatural Selection, How We Are Changing Life Gene by Gene. I'm Heather Goldstone. This is Living Lab. Thanks for listening.